I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Sugar, meat, and milk were all rationed during World War I. To make up for the lack of basic food, people created victory gardens. Today we'll discover how popular they were and the multiple purposes they served. Their legacy continues here in the metro as community gardens wage war against food deserts and poor nutrition, and we'll ask what it takes to make those a success. Then, congratulations, you're expecting a baby. Our smart money experts are here with thoughts on budgeting before the baby comes, who should stay home with your child, and saving up for the best education possible. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. There was a time when the world was at war that saw the general population answer the call to grow food in a time of rationing. Proudly called victory gardens, they became a symbol of patriotic duty. These days, another war rages in the food deserts of inner cities, Kansas City included, and another cultivating program looks for victory in community gardens. This morning, a look at gardening as more than a passion of home cooks and foodies. This is a look at how individuals grow produce, not on an industrial scale, but in small lots, made a difference 100 years ago, and they're making a difference today. With us, Doran Card is a senior curator for the World War I Museum. Welcome back, Doran. Nice to have you.
Hi, Steve. Good morning.
Tamara Rial is a field specialist in horticulture for the Jackson County Extension Center. Tamara, nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
How did Victory Gardens come about, Doran?
Well, they really started for two reasons. One is because there was a lot of food that was being sent overseas to support both the Allies, and then later when the Americans entered the war in April of 1917, they had to feed an army of 4 million. And the other was to make people at home who didn't really have a direct connection with the war by giving them a garden, as they first called them, a peace garden, then they would feel like they had a connection with the war itself.
You know, America, just from reading about this, had learned some important lessons in World War I about all this. Like what?
Well, they really learned that you have a contribution to make regardless of what your status in the community is. And the gardens, at first called Liberty Gardens, then War Gardens, and then eventually Victory Gardens, that you could have a part in the greater aspect of a world war, and not just to grow food, but to grow support for what was going on.
At that time, just to give people a scope of these projects, Americans were encouraged to turn, you know, schoolyards and company grounds, parks, backyards, vacant lots, you name it, into these victory gardens. That's covering a lot of ground.
It really was, and it was ground that was basically seen as just patches of grass that could be converted into growing tomatoes and growing beets or whatever the products that they were growing, and it was really land that was available to anyone at the time.
Was it almost any available space? Is that what we're talking about here?
Basically, unless it was a military-controlled area, you could use any space, any public space. And they also encourage people to use their backyards, to use their front yards to really, if their neighbor wasn't able to grow one, to help their neighbor grow one of the gardens.
And how much did people participate in all this? What do we know about that?
Well, it was really astounding. They didn't really keep a lot of figures, but I did look up that Minnesota really led the nation. And they noted that they, in the Minneapolis Garden Club, they had 10,000 war gardens, and it was 30% more than the next most productive city surveyed.
10,000.
And they were growing 2,100, they had 2,100 acres in production and were saving basically $1 million of garden goods in 1918.
How focused a public campaign, Doran, did President Wilson wage to encourage Americans to grow produce, again, back in World War I?
Well, he really had an organization called the National War Gardens Commission, and he really supported that. That was part of what he supported. And then Herbert Hoover came in to supply the foodstuffs for the people in Europe, our allies in Europe.
And this is Herbert Hoover before he became president.
Yeah. And he was very important in that. He was seen as basically a hero in Belgium for supplying vast quantities of wheat and other products like that to them. And it really helped lead to his election as president later on.
There turned out to be meatless Mondays, they were called, and wheatless Wednesdays. What were those days?
Well, basically exactly what you said. On Monday, don't eat meat, and on Wednesdays, don't eat wheat. And it was a nice alliteration of meat and wheat, but wheat was indeed a huge product that was important because the main staple was bread for people, especially in Europe and other areas of the globe. But they really followed that almost to the thing. But it made a nice – it was a nice campaign.
Did Americans follow those dictates? I mean, did it become a peer pressure kind of thing?
I think it really was. There was nobody going around, you know,
checking
on it or anything like that. But you probably got looked askance at if you went in and bought a big bunch of meat on a Monday. So wait until Tuesday, and you know you could do that. You couldn't get a lot. America really didn't ration a lot of materials in World War I, but it was a peer pressure that occurred. And one thing that I kind of thought was important was that the children had a huge part in this effort.
And
there was actually an organization, and it was called the U.S. School Garden. Army. They call it the U.S. School Garden Army. And millions of children took part in this. Whether they actually grew something that contributed to the war effort, it contributed to their efforts and their feeling of goodwill.
You know, this effort proved so successful that they actually passed out information on canning and drying manuals to preserve surplus products. I mean, this was a really comprehensive deal.
Oh, it really was. And it then carried over. Not necessarily the gardens themselves, but this whole idea of, you know, preserving food and keeping it in times of need really did continue over. I saw that with a lot of my relatives over the years in the country, especially in the countryside where they did that.
How much of all this effort then carried over to World War II?
Well, in World War II, it was even larger because the participation and the population was larger by 1941. But it really followed the same pattern, and that it was an important part of the home effort to grow food.
You know, if any of our listeners recall these victory gardens being grown in their neighborhoods or even in their backyards, we'd like to hear from you. 816-235-2888 is our number, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, I was struck, Doran, that even Eleanor Roosevelt, the First Lady of the United States, grew produce on the grounds of the White House. What do we know about that?
Well, I know that she was very concerned with the people that got her husband really into office. But even in World War I, there was an effort not necessarily for food, but Mrs. Woodrow Wilson, she raised sheep on the lawn of the White House because she led a nationwide knitting effort. And so she raised her own wool for her knitting club. So she wasn't raising the food, but she was still contributing to the war effort.
I can't help but wonder about those who were living overseas during World War II, Doran. Londoners, the cities under siege, the Nazis are bombing London, bombing England. How did they do the gardens over there as well?
It was done in areas that were not affected. Of course, you know, you're talking World War II, so you've taken me out of my comfort zone here,
yeah,
Steve.
Right.
But it wasn't a very important part, especially even in the occupied areas, the German occupied areas of France, because they weren't getting any other kind of material, because most of it was going into the war effort.
Well, Tamara Rio, again, from the Jackson County Extension Center, let's turn to you here. Is it fair to say that community gardens today you know, serve a similar purpose to those gardens of old to stave off hunger among endangered parts of the population?
Oh, absolutely. There, community gardens today take many different forms or flavors, if you will. We have gardens that are food pantry gardens. Two of our big pantry gardens are 18th and Broadway and 10th and Jefferson. And they,
how big are those gardens?
They're pretty big. That 18th and Broadway is, it's, I can't give you the exact acreage, but I mean, it's a good sized garden. And the 10th and Jefferson one is a little bit smaller. In the last 2 years with these gardens, we've produced 15,000 pounds of food that has been donated to pantries. So these are areas that people from the community actually come on their lunch break or after work to garden, and then it's harvested and given to these pantries. And these are sponsored by businesses here in Kansas City. So DST and wow. PAC Development, they sponsor the care of these gardens.
Do people sort of respond based on a schedule, like Bill and John will come after work on Tuesday and then Sarah and Jean will come on Friday? I mean, how does it work?
Well, we have a horticulture educator who manages all of that. So
wow.
she meets with the different groups and she sends them weekly updates, lets them know what they can plant, what needs to be harvested, when things need to be taken care of.
I was going to say, I'm told that you have these master gardeners who manage historical gardens, two historical gardens. What are those about?
Well, our master gardeners, and actually there's master gardeners in pretty much every state, and they all have demonstration gardens. We have master gardeners that have that manage 17 different gardens here in the Kansas City area. Some of our historical gardens, like Atkins Johnson and Watkins Mill, mm-hmm. are historical gardens, and they will produce food that was grown with the original owners. So these are plants that are all heirlooms, grown in the 1800s and early 1900s. And so there are different challenges when doing heirloom gardens versus what we are able to do in some of the other gardens.
What's the point of doing an heirloom garden?
Well, it promotes, well, it's kind of like a history or, mm-hmm. or a museum. So we're able to maintain the genetics from these plants.
Wow.
And
wow.
we're also able to keep those traditions alive.
So would some of the plants in those gardens, you know, possibly have been in the Victory Gardens during World War II? Is that what we're talking about?
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I mean, all of these same plants. So, like, you can grow lettuce and kale and peas, spinach, all of these, and we grow those in our modern day gardens as well.
Right.
And we can actually grow three different seasons. And if you have high tunnel greenhouse, you can grow all year round. But in the spring, we'll put in our peas and lettuce, spinach, radishes, beets, all of those.
Right.
And then in the summer, we'll then start planting beans, squashes and melons, tomatoes, peppers, even peanuts.
Wow, even peanuts.
Even peanuts. And then as those start going along, as they get harvested, then we go back and we plant some of our cool season vegetables again.
Okay, dumb question here. How do you grow peanuts?
Well, we have fact sheets. We have lots of guide sheets.
Are they like underground?
They are, yeah. So they're not a true nut, but they do grow underground. They're kind of a tuber that'll grow underground. And so all you see is the leafy matter. And then when it's time to harvest, then you'll pull them out and clean out the dirt.
Did not know that. Okay, 816-235-2888. We're talking about Victory Gardens and then how they relate to today's community gardens. Let's go to Frank from Kansas City, Missouri. Frank, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
Well, thanks, Frank.
Hey, when she came on or you came on and said the words of Victory Gardens, boy, I had a flashback, huh. and it was cool. My dad worked for the Vindo Company, which was a company in Kansas City that made Coca-Cola machines, and during World War II, they turned everything to the war effort and made weapons. But the company had a Victory Garden down right on the north side of Old 40 Highway where the Blue River goes under there.
Right.
And everybody in the company could have a patch in that garden. And we would go there two or three times a week and work in our garden. And I was like 4 years old. Huh. And I remember that. I remember picking tomatoes and cucumbers and putting stuff in a paper bag and bringing it home and eating it. And
I was going to say, when you're a little kid, Frank, that's a big kick, isn't it?
Oh, man, it was awesome. It was awesome. At the time, there was a little airport down there.
Huh.
And the airplanes would be taking off and landing. I don't know. You know, you have to be pretty old to remember Heart of America Airport, but there was an airport down there. And, just hearing the word Victory Garden just sent me off on a little streak of deja vu.
Well, I'm really glad you called, Frank. Thanks for sharing those memories. I appreciate it.
Hey, thank you.
You know, Tamara, I was wondering, do members of the community that benefit from the food actually end up working in some of the gardens? Do they help out?
Yes. In fact, one of our gardens, it's the Ivanhoe Community Gardens. It's been a partnership with the Master Gardeners. They approached us, and we were able to create this garden there. We first started out with helping building the gardens, but then the community has actually come in and they have gotten so involved in it that there's not as much for us to do as Master Gardeners.
Mm-hmm.
And our goal with our Master Gardener gardens is to provide a place where people can learn how to garden, but also it allows the community to come in, learn how to do it, and then we can give it back to the community.
Yeah. I was going to say, what kind of community ends up forming around the gardeners who are volunteering their time to do some of this work?
You're asking what kind of people want to be a master gardener?
What kind of community? I imagine this kind of becomes kind of a friendly deal for a lot of people.
Well, yeah. Our people come to garden for all sorts of reasons. People want to learn how to garden. People want to have people with common interests.
And it's kind of a fun activity for a lot of people. Get out of the office a little bit and go help out.
Oh, it is. So we're like the 18th and Broadway and 10th and Jefferson. Yeah, they'll come out during their lunch breaks. These are not necessarily Master Gardeners, though Master Gardeners are involved in the 18th and Broadway. But in all the different community gardens, people do come for different reasons. It might be that they just need to stretch their dollars, or they want to have that connection with the earth. People come for all sorts of reasons, but some wonderful things come about it. One, you do get that connection with nature. And it also, it builds your morale. There's something magical about growing something from a seed and then having it on your table.
Yeah, absolutely. And I totally get that. Well, what crops grow well in the community gardens and which have proven to be the most popular over time?
Really, any of those that I've said. Some of the ones that grow really fast are great starters. So lettuce, I have lettuce growing on my porch. So you don't even need a garden space. You can have container gardens. Some of our most popular are sweet potatoes.
Really?
Because they get so big. So at the end of the harvest, we'll have Boy Scouts come in and help us harvest, and those potatoes can be as big as their head.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. You know, it strikes me, too, that back in the early 20th century that many people still cook with fresh food, but maybe not as – that doesn't happen quite as much today. Do people know how to prepare all the fruits and veggies that come out of these community gardens?
They might not. And so with MU Extension, we also have many different programs. So we have a nutritionist that can help you learn how to use that food. They can also help you learn how to can and preserve that food.
How do people connect with these programs if they're hearing this and they're interested in getting involved?
Well, I'd encourage you to call your local Extension office.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can go to our website. It's extension.missouri.edu. We have lots of programs that are available.
You know, Doran, where were they able to get the seeds for the different gardens we're talking about back in World War I, World War II?
Well, they were really given opportunities to gather them at different places that would have the seeds and the produce available that they could plant. And so it was really available to them. The industries provided a lot of this that had been producing the seeds on a regular basis, then provided it for the gardens themselves.
Yeah.
So it was really an effort.
I can't help about sort of the sense of community and this idea of this patriotic activity that people took part in back in those days. You don't see those same kinds of activities today.
Well, I don't think so, because we don't have the involvement with the totality of a total war like World War
One. Of course, yeah.
And so we don't really know what has lost and what is lost in these areas where war occurs, but there are still people who do take care of that and help with those efforts in various countries around the world. And so you don't necessarily need a full-blown world war to have people help other people, and we see that with the community gardens and things that are where these materials are available to them. So it's really more of a human effort and a human concern for other humans.
How does the World War I Museum commemorate the Victory Gardens?
Well, we have several objects in our collection, and one of them, which I think is very ironic, we have a sign from the Germantown, Pennsylvania garden. And so, you know, here's Germantown, Pennsylvania, growing fruits and vegetables and fighting against the Germans. And then we have a lot of posters that were put out to advertise to people. And one of my favorite posters is these little vegetables with faces on them and little legs, and they're running away from the gardener, you know, because she's coming to harvest them and they're trying to get away. So they even injected some humor into it. So we have a lot of materials like that in the collection.
Okay. Well, we'll leave our conversation there about Victory Gardens from World War One and World War Two and community gardens today. Those were the voices of Doran Cart, a senior curator for the World War One Museum. Tamara Rial is a field specialist in horticulture for the Jackson County Extension Center. Thank you both for good conversation. Sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, our Smart Money team will be here, and they'll talk about how to prepare and plan for a baby coming into the family. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Friday in the show, we talked with NPR national correspondent Sarah McCammon about her work as a political reporter and her upbringing right here in Kansas City. That and other previous episodes, you'll find them at kcur.org/up-to-date. Don't forget, Tuesday is Election Day here in Kansas City. KCUR 89.3 and kcur.org is the place to stay updated on those results. And join Up-to-Date on Wednesday for post-election wrap up and a conversation with Kansas City's next mayor. That's Wednesday on KCUR's Up to Date. So you're expecting a baby. Congratulations. That's great news. Hate to burst your bubble. It can also be expensive news. In fact, it can be really expensive. The good news, our smart money experts are here to give you a few tips for how to navigate the financial road ahead with your growing family. With us, David Jackson is a certified financial planner, practitioner, and financial advisor for Waddell and Reed Financial Advisors. David, good morning. Welcome back.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
Jimmy Bossi is a financial planner and life transition specialist at Aspire Wealth. Jamie, good morning to you. Nice to have you.
Good morning, Steve.
Kristen Bookman is with the Trust Company in Manhattan, Kansas, and she brings a different perspective to our conversation today because she is pregnant with her first child. Kristen, congratulations. Welcome.
Thank you.
When's the big day?
August 15th is the big day. So
a couple months to go.
Nearing the countdown.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Again, just to remind our listeners, the information presented by our guests is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as a recommendation or advice related to your personal situation. Please consult with a professional prior to making any financial decisions here. David, let's begin as we usually do with sort of current events in the world of personal finance. And there are a whole lot of concerns out there about trade involving Mexico, involving China. What's been going on?
Well, with the discussions we've had about tariffs, we keep hearing from the politicians that the other country is paying for it, but what it ends up acting like is a tax to the consumer because they just pass those costs on.
Right.
So that's had the markets a little bit nervous because if you make things more expensive, people will buy less. And, you know, eventually that affects the overall economy.
Although, by and large, personal spending has been pretty strong of late, if I hear my news headlines correctly.
Yeah, it's been hanging in there, and personal income has been going up a little bit as well. So, you know, giving people room or a little bit of margin to continue spending.
Okay. Well, Jamie, let's turn to our main topic here, and that's planning for a new arrival and how to begin to prepare for a new baby in the house. There are lots of things to think about here. Run down some of the different topics we might be discussing here this morning.
I can do that. So babies are expensive. You know, you not only do you have to equip your house with all sorts of new furniture, you have to buy car seats and strollers.
Gear, they call it these days. Yeah.
Exactly. There's so many new expenses, not to mention all the newer monthly expenses you'll have with the diapers and formula and baby food and things like that. So it's really important now more than ever to get a handle on, you know, what those items look like and how you're going to fund them going forward.
Okay, Kristen, let's turn to one topic here, which is cash flow and budgeting. What kinds of advice do you give your clients about beginning to think about managing money for a new arrival coming up down the road? And maybe you're already in the middle of doing that yourself right now.
Yeah, the first thing is really just getting a handle on those inflows and outflows. So, again, knowing that income that's coming in and then looking at current expenses and then trying to account for some of those things Jamie mentioned. So, you know, what's daycare going to cost? What do you estimate diapers are going to cost as well? And looking at all those new expenses and adding them to your budget and seeing where you're coming out. There are several different tools you can use. So, again, apps out there. Mint.com is a great one for budgeting. And so if you're not sure where to start, that's a great place to start. Or, you know, just writing it down on a piece of paper and starting there. But getting the handle on those inflows and outflows is crucial for kind of the first step in preparing for this child.
You know, I got to believe, David, that there has got to be some notion of sticker shock for so many parents who have no idea, you know, what daycare costs these days, what childcare costs these days, and they haven't really zeroed in on the cost of a college education lately. I mean, those numbers can really buckle somebody's knees.
Oh, that is absolutely true. I was doing a little research over the weekend. I ran across this article that said the Department of Agriculture had done some run some numbers, and they said it cost about $233,000 to raise a child from 0 to age 17, not including college. And so you had college that you made double that number. So, you know, it's just expensive.
Yeah. Well, there are ways to begin to think about saving some money as people begin to go out and buy all this gear we mentioned earlier, Jamie. I'm thinking of consignment sales, garage sales, social networks. Fill us in on what people might think about there.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a lot of ways to get great used items. You can borrow them from friends and family members. And there's so many groups now with like Facebook online to search for buy, sell, trade, things like that. And you can even post that you're searching for a specific item and see if anyone in your area has it for sale.
You know, I think a lot of parents think, I am not going to buy something new for my precious new child. And they end up spending crazy money for stuff that's sort of just right around the corner and it's out there, right?
It's for sure. And I have some experience with this because I have four children. And I'll tell you, with the first one, you do get kind of wrapped up in thinking you need the brand new thing and it has to be the latest model. But then once you get to number four, you're borrowing whatever you can.
It doesn't matter anymore, does it?
Yeah. Exactly.
What is that about the fourth child compared to the first child and how things change so much? Okay. Let's turn to maternity leave here, Kristen. That's a concept, again, that a lot of folks, it'll be new to them. They have to navigate how their company policies operate. Tell us about maternity leave.
Yeah, exactly. So every company is going to be different. It may be a combination of sick leave, vacation time. There could be short-term disability benefits. So every company is different and just getting familiar with their policy, both for maternity leave and then there is some paternity leave as well these days. And so making sure that you have a handle on that if you're a couple from both perspectives. And Jamie, I don't know if you have anything to add, but having gone through that, may have some experience there.
Sure. Yeah. And I think the disability policy is the most confusing part of it all.
Yes.
You know, you have this vague language that says you'll get paid 60% of your pay for 12 weeks. And so the new expectant family expects 12 weeks of pay at 60%. But there's actually a lot of rules in there. So, you know, a birth actually qualifies for 6 to 8 weeks of pay only. And then there's a 2-week to 1-week waiting period, depending on the policy. So you might actually just be paid 60% of pay for 4 weeks.
And you're talking about what? What is this the federal law you're talking about? Or what category are you addressing here?
This is the disability policy typically offered through employers or if you have a policy
right.
on your own.
Yeah. So people really need to understand what this is because it catches a lot of people short, I'm guessing.
Exactly. Yeah. And it takes, you know, it takes a lot of people off guard. And, you know, you read the policy and you see, oh, 12 weeks of pay. And so that's what you think is happening.
But certain companies are more generous with their policies, right?
They are. A lot of companies have come around. You know, as Kristen mentioned, there's paternity leave now, which wasn't a thing even a few years ago. And a lot of them will have, you know, ways to incorporate your vacation pay or do other things where they'll pay you while you're gone.
And so some companies then, with paternity leave thrown in, you can do, mom can take some time off, and then dad can take some time off and sort of stack the experience together?
Exactly. And so planning that and making sure that you have that conversation and you have a plan going forward for both spouses, yes, certainly, mom could take some time off, and then father could as well. Maybe could overlap for a little bit of time, too.
Yeah, Lucas Book School, who's also, you know, part of our Smart Money team, took advantage of paternity leave with his last child. It's something was unheard of, you know, when you and I were having kids. But
times are changing.
Times are changing fast.
You're going to put me in the same category as you here, aren't you?
Yeah, you got gray hair too. Yeah. I can see it.
Don't we all? Yeah. Well, let's turn to child care, David. This is maybe one of the biggest and most stressful decisions for most families when having a child. How would you begin to advise a family to navigate child care?
You know, that was interesting talking to Jamie and Kristen before we came out here about how you do have to plan early for the child care because getting into a facility or getting into a place, a lot of times they have these long waiting lists where, you know, if you haven't made plans in advance, you may be stuck, you know. So
you hear about parents sometimes putting their names in even before they get pregnant. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, no, it's insane. I mean,
yeah.
And then the cost, you know, that was another thing we discussed is I did some research and it was saying anywhere from 9 to 22% of the household income can be going towards child care, you know, so that's comparable to a mortgage. And I think you had mentioned, what were you just saying a little while ago?
Yes. Yeah, so once I had my second kid, my daycare payments were about equal to my mortgage. And now that I have four, it's quite a bit more than my mortgage.
No kidding.
I know, it's
unreal. Again, that's going to surprise a lot of people out there who just aren't thinking along those lines. This idea that there's long waiting lists for certain types of facilities, you know, Jamie, what facilities are we talking about that would command long waiting lists like that?
Well, there's a lot of great facilities that are daycare centers that are they're formal, organized education, where they have age-based education for different ages of children, and it's very structured programming. So if you want to get into there, a lot of times there's a waiting list because they only allow a certain amount of kids per room and things like that. There's other options like in-home daycares, or if you're fortunate enough to have family in town that wants to take on that job, that will work really well. I know Kristen's going to be taking advantage of that.
Yeah, well, you have family around?
Yeah, so we actually have a family member that will be providing daycare for us, but does go back to those consignment sales and Facebook and using those. We've had to help build up that daycare center for our family member, and so we have taken advantage of several of those consignment sales and Facebook sales as well to help not only prepare our own home, but also our daycare too. So.
Well, there are several different types of centers here for child care. There's daycare centers, there's in-home care, nannies, family member obviously can be part of this, one parent staying home. Of all those, which one is the most expensive? Any clue?
It's going to be that daycare center that Jamie mentioned,
right.
Is typically what you see for being the most expensive.
And I bet nannies sort of come pretty quickly after
pretty
that.
Close.
Then, right?
Yeah, pretty close, because you are dependent on one person, and so making sure that they're taken care of.
Jamie, how did you navigate figuring out where you wanted to put your first child? Because that's a big decision for a lot of parents.
It is. I visited a lot of different varieties of places. So I looked at a lot of daycare centers. I looked at a lot of in-home places.
Yeah. I remember doing that too. I remember I was really kind of nervous about it because you don't know these people very well. Right. And you're thinking you're now about to hand them your child and you don't even know who they are, you know.
So. Exactly. In the end, I was the most comfortable with the daycare center because you knew there's more than one adult there. You know that they're kind of regulating each other and they have a structure, so they've done it before.
Yeah, but still, the first time you drop that child off, boy, that is a moment. If our listeners want to take part in our conversation, we'd like to have you. Your questions about how to handle your budget when a new baby is coming into the household, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. You can also tweet us at KCUR up to date. David, what about this decision about should one parent stay home? And this is a big decision with a lot of financial considerations hanging all over it. Walk me through how you talk to parents about that.
Well, it's a huge decision, and it's not just a financial decision. I mean, so, you know, if you're taking one part, and it used to be that, you know, we just assume if anybody's going to stay home, it's going to be mom. But nowadays, you know, with equal pay, if the wife is making substantially more money, in a lot of cases, I'm seeing, you know, dad staying at home. Mm-hmm. And it's not that uncommon anymore.
Yeah.
And so you have to work that in. You also have to think, well, if you're going to stay at home, you're actually exiting your career for a while. What is that going to do to your career down the road? And we've had a lot of conversations over the years about unequal pay for women. And a lot of times that's because they've taken those breaks from their career to raise children. Mm-hmm. And then trying to catch up from that, you know, it takes a while.
Yeah.
So these are decisions that need to be thought through, not just the financial cost, but the financial cost is probably the biggest one, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. And then in the long term, too, you know, if one spouse does stay home, they're missing out on that retirement savings and their 401k
right.
while they were working.
Right.
And a lot of times those are your kind of prime earning years where you're getting bigger bumps in pay. So if you mm-hmm. miss that when you come back into the workforce, if you come back, you probably aren't going to start right where you were. You'd take a little bit of a cut.
Kristen, I'm curious about how you've decided to navigate this big decision.
For us, with a family member that was willing to provide daycare, it made sense for both of us to stay at our current jobs. And again, it was that career path. We're young in our career, and we wanted to make sure that we had the momentum going forward. And it would have been hard for us to take that time off and then jump back into things with our personal situation. And then again, having that family member being
yeah.
willing to help us.
Yeah, you kind of got the best situation
yeah.
there. I have a lot of retirees as clients, and it's the mix. You know, there's some grandparents who are saying, oh, I can't wait to take care of my grandkids. You go back to work, I'll take care of them. And I have just as many that say, no, they're not settling me down with these grandkids. I didn't retire to do this. I'm going to go off and have my own fun.
So, I want to go play golf.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, Kristen, you're lucky in that sense.
Jimmy, what did you decide to do in your situation?
Yep, so I continued working and just used the daycare centers.
And it worked out.
It's working
well,
yeah. And for me, I think, you know, some people are well suited for, you know, staying at home with children, and I don't think it would be as good for my mental health.
Oh, and that's a consideration, right?
Exactly.
At least you know yourself well enough to know what you might be suitable for and comfortable with. Okay, let's go back to some phone calls here. 816-235-2888 is our number. Kat from Prairie Village, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to share from the daycare angle. We have lots of people have heard of Head Start, which serves, I think, ages 4 through 5. But there is also Early Head Start for ages 0 to 3. And so I know in KCK and out in Olathe, there are day centers. So it's educational programming daycare for kids that age and for families that will qualify. That can be a low-cost or no-cost option. So that's a really great resource that we have.
So this is early. What did you call this again, Kat? Early childhood, early daycare?
It's called Early Head Start. And so it's a federally funded and regulated program, but different centers or organizations will get the contract to do it in the community. So up in Wyandotte, there's Project Eagle, and then there's a site down in Olathe. I think it's through a church down in Olathe. But yeah, really great option, especially if we're thinking of maybe single parents that are out there with lower incomes.
How can people connect with Early Head Start? Where can they get information about that?
I would, honestly, I would just Google it, or definitely in the Kansas City, Kansas area, Project Eagle is who you would want to contact.
Project Eagle, okay. Mm-hmm. And what is Project Eagle?
They're an agency located in downtown KCK, and they do some different programming, but they are an educare site, so they are, at least they used to be, which is kind of a next-level stamp of approval of really good educational practices, and they do in-home services, so stay-at-home parents or parents when they are home can get a visit with educational information, or they have a daycare on-site with classrooms starting from baby all the way up through.
All right.
I'm not sure what age. Yeah.
Well, Kat, you're full of information. Thanks so much for calling today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate the show. Take care.
You bet. Bye-bye.
You know, I'm really happy that Kat brought up the single-parent issue, because that's become a bigger and bigger issue over time. And they don't have the support that, you know, in a lot of cases that, you know, married couples do. And they're trying to do it all alone. And it creates its own unique challenges.
Yeah. I just really struck by your comment a few minutes ago, Jamie, about the whole notion of, you know, you felt you were a little more cut out to stay in the workforce than sticking around the house. And again, that's, you know, figuring that out about yourself is something that might be a really good step for moms and dads to navigate sooner rather than later.
For sure. Yeah, and I think you don't really know until you get closer to it and kind of when you get into it as well. And things change once you are starting to get going in your career and you feel really good about what you're doing on a daily basis.
Right.
But then you have that precious child come into your life that you know you also love a lot and you want to be a part of. But I've just found that it's nice to be away from them for some of the day, and I feel like it's better for both of us to have that time.
You can be a better mom in the long run if you have a little bit of break now and then, which
exactly
a sentiment I can completely relate with. Yeah. Let's go back to some calls at 816-235-2888. Elizabeth from Overland Park, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I was just going to make the comment because people were saying paternity leave is fairly recent. My husband and I had our daughters in 1990 and 1994. We worked for DuPont in the Boston area, and he was also able to take paternity leave at the time they were born. So it made it easier for me to go back to work knowing that they would be home with Dad. And then when they would cry at night, they were equally happy to see Dad or Mom walk into their room.
Oh, that's
so
great.
That's just my comment.
So it worked out pretty well for you guys, it sounds like.
Oh, it worked out. It worked out great.
Yeah.
We have two wonderful adult daughters now.
Good for you. Elizabeth, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let's go to Amy from Olathe. Amy, you're on Up to Date.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm well, Amy. Thanks.
Wonderful. Well, hey, I just wanted to bring a comment to the conversation. I currently have a little over 1.5-year-old son, and we're expecting baby number two. And
congratulations.
I used to be a full-time teacher, and I actually decided to stay at home with him. However, now that he's kind of getting, you know, older, and I'm noticing his social needs are a little bit harder to be met than just being with mom at home. And I was able to have a few play dates with someone, but it's nothing quite substantial.
Mm-hmm.
So I was struggling with, okay, does he need to be in part-time daycare, you know, to get more early development skills that I can't necessarily provide along with social skills. And I was actually able to find a really great resource out in Olathe through a local church. My husband and I aren't necessarily very religious. However, it's a great resource. It's two mornings a week, and it's about $150 per month.
Wow,
so,
that sounds pretty reasonable. Yeah.
Yeah, so we're very strapped for cash. We're on a one-family income, and, you know, I was very anxious looking for options that could still stick within our budget. So I was really happy to find this resource. I'm actually going to be talking more specifics with them tomorrow. But if for those parents that might be wanting a little bit more social interactions for their kids, local churches could offer a really great resource.
It's a great recommendation, Amy.
Okay, well, thanks, Steve.
Thanks very much. You bet. Have a good day.
Have a great day.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
David Jackson, tell us about employee benefit changes and how that plays into the decision to leave the workforce to take care of a child.
Well, a lot of times that's a big impact on which adult decides to stay at home. If one of them is going to stay home, who's going to have the better benefits that'll take care of the family? You know, mm-hmm. So you have the health insurance, life insurance, disability, all those things. You know, if one one of the couple has really good benefits and the other one doesn't, that may weigh into it.
And you wouldn't think having a child would be all that complicated, but there's lots of things.
Man, there's so many things to think about.
Lots of things to think about. Yeah. Well, you're a grandparent. I mean, do you stick around and help out and look after the kids, or is that not something you want to do?
Well, my wife does.
Your wife does. That's not your thing, though, eh?
Yeah, it's not my thing. Like Jamie was saying, it's like you got to know your place.
Yeah, and you know yours.
Yeah, I know mine.
Jamie, how about life insurance? What should people think about on that front here?
Life insurance, a lot of times people just take the life insurance that's offered through their work and they think it's enough. Most parents are grossly underinsured. The idea with life insurance at this point is to replace income if you are no longer around, since you have dependents depending on that income. And it's also important to insure the non-working spouse if there is a non-working spouse, because if they passed away, then you'd be having to pay a lot more in childcare expenses,
right,
and other things.
So you need to think about things like the cost of higher education, think about the cost of daycare, if it's private school, whatever it is, you have to factor that in into how much you might need. Advise people. People never know how much they need. What's a good rule of thumb?
A good rule of thumb is 7 to 10 times your income.
7 to 10 times your income. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that can be kind of pricey for people too.
It can be, but a lot of times it's a lot more reasonable than you think. You know, at this stage, especially just insuring a parent, if you look at term insurance options, they can be, you know, really reasonable. So, you know, for instance, if we were looking at a $75,000 per year income times 10, that's $750,000 in life insurance need. You know, that could be maybe $500 to $800 a year, depending if you're a healthy non-smoker.
Right. How about estate planning and beneficiary designation, Kristen? Again, something else to think about here.
Yes, estate planning is just as important as life insurance when you're preparing for a child. So most young parents don't have estate planning documents, and that's where you'll designate a guardian for that child if something were to happen to the parent. So making sure that those documents are in place, and then also making sure that you update beneficiary designations after that child's born.
And it's not too early, as soon as a child is born, to begin thinking about higher education, too. Just take it from me. Saving for that sooner rather than later is a really good idea. I want to thank our smart money experts here, David Jackson, a financial advisor for Waddell & Reed Financial Advisors, Jamie Bossi, a financial planner and life transitions specialist at Aspire Wealth, and Kristen Bookman is from the Trust Company out in Manhattan, Kansas. Thank you all for good information today. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve.
Tomorrow on the show, the outlandish, hilarious, and deeply terrifying international spy schemes that almost happened. We'll find out why they were ultimately left on the drawing board. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Elizabeth Ruiz, as well as Emily Aiken. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.